From the Sky News Centre at 5, the Home Secretary says an Irish-related terror attack in Great Britain is a strong possibility. In a statement, Theresa May has announced the threat level has increased from moderate to substantial. The head of MI5 warned last week that dissident Irish Republicans could attempt to mount a new wave of attacks on the British mainland. Our reporter David Blevins has more from Belfast.
We've seen something like 40 attacks in the space of this year alone, so the security forces here, certainly on this side of the Irish Sea, have been very aware of the capability of these various factions, and I'm sure they will not be at all surprised that the threat level has been raised.
Police are continuing to search a park in Prestwich in Greater Manchester tonight after the murder of a woman. The murder weapon, believed to be a knife, has not been found. A 40-year-old man is in police custody in hospital. Divisional Commander John Rush says it's a major inquiry.
It's early days in the investigation for us, and at the moment the main priorities are, you know, the examination of the scenes in the park, trying to identify formally the victim, speak to the family members as well. There are some injuries to the man. We don't know whether they're self-inflicted, and I wouldn't like to say if they are.
A former postman who befriended young victims while on his rounds has been jailed for 8.5 years. Paedophile Michael Williams from Cornwall used Facebook and Bebo to contact them using fake profiles. The 28-year-old also used his position as secretary of Falmouth Town Football Club to target youngsters. It seems even royalty worry about their heating bills. It's emerged one of the Queen's aides asked if she could apply for a handout. The request was turned down by the government in 2004. Scotland will be going to the Commonwealth Games. The team have joined England and Wales in confirming that they definitely will compete in India, despite concerns over safety and facilities. And as Coronation Street prepares to mark its 50th anniversary, fans are being told to expect death and destruction with a tram crash. A special live episode could also include CGI, which has never been attempted before. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Jewell.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
BCFM is a community radio station for Bristol. So, what exactly does that mean?
Well, it means that anybody can get involved in any way you want.
Yeah, but what if you haven't done radio before?
That doesn't matter, because BCFM have qualified tutors that run training courses that tell you everything you need to know.
To find out more information, go to www.bcfm.org.uk.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody a Bristol voice.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's politics show. That's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and my guest to review this week's news in Bristol, Britain and around the world is Lib Dem councillor for Clifton, Trevor Blythe. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the result of the first round in the Labour Party leadership election will be announced tomorrow. Martin will be sizing up the candidates and explaining how Labour's complicated electoral college system to choose a leader works. And a horrific assassination in London a week ago of Pakistani politician Imran Farooq. We saw his wife on TV yesterday pleading for information that might help police catch his killers. But who was he? And what did he represent in his party's home base, Karachi? That's in the second hour. On to our review of this week's news in a minute, but first here's our two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. This weekend, highs of 13 degrees Celsius. Yes, we're all wearing our woolly sweaters here in the studio today. Dry and sunny, though, all weekend. Next week, highs of 17. That's up a little, mixture of sunny spells with some showers. Next weekend, that's the 2nd and 3rd of October, highs of 13 degrees Celsius. Cool again, rain with some gusty winds on Saturday, sunnier next Sunday. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests now, and with me is Lib Dem councillor for Clifton, Trevor Blythe.
Hello.
Now, Trevor, what's your background before you got into politics? And were are you actually from Bristol yourself?
No, I'm from South London. My background has been a lifetime in the print industry, mainly producing high-volume consumer magazines.
What sort of magazines? So you're actually printing these magazines?
Well, I was director in charge of manufacturing at one time and commercial aspects another.
So for which company? Because it was a big printing company?
Yeah, it was St Ives PLC.
Okay. So what brought you into politics then?
Well, I've always been interested in the Liberal Democrats, and I felt that as I took early retirement, it would be nice to actually try and put something back into the community.
So why the Liberal Democrats? Why not one of the other parties? What was it about them that appealed to you?
Because I felt that they... I mean, a lot of people say they sit on the fence, but that was quite all right for me because they always seem to have the most considered views on things and weren't extreme in any way. And I support the, you know, Trident being scrapped and that type of thing, and it seemed the right party. And also, they were the right party in Bristol. As we'd suffered quite a lot from a rather strange Labour administration for a number of years, and it helped the Lib Dems help bring us some new life into the council and try and restore the residents' faith in the council.
So what do you think the Lib Dems running the city council has meant for people that the Labour Party couldn't deliver beforehand then?
Well, I think a certain amount of transparency, and we've been able to introduce a number of things like neighbourhood partnerships and so on, which hopefully brings running the neighbourhoods and the council closer to the residents.
Now, you did say before, we were sitting down just now, about neighbourhood partnerships. These are things, well, what exactly are they? Is something that you're championing?
Well, the neighbourhood partnerships are basically devolving a certain amount of financial discretion to the residents within a neighbourhood to actually decide for themselves which bits of road they want resurfaced and how their waste is collected and other amenity type things.
But I mean, surely the people just want the council to get on with that. They don't want to have to be bothered with it. You know, it's pretty obvious, surely, which roads need resurfacing.
Well, they do, but of course the budget will never stretch as far as having all the roads resurfaced. So, for instance, in my neighbourhood partnership, which is Cabot, Clifton and Clifton East, we were presented with a choice of roads that could be done within the budget, and the residents decided which roads they wanted done first. And, of course, the residents always know where the black spots are, they know where the parking pinches are, they know where people leave their bins out and so on. And, it's engaging the community in running the community and not just leaving it up to faceless officials in the council house.
So is this part of David Cameron's big society you're sort of latching this onto?
Well, no, because we started it before David Cameron's big society, but it's echoing what is already in train in Bristol and in most of the other major core cities.
So is it the partners are the people and the council, are they? Is that what you mean by a partnership?
Well, the partnership is obviously the residents and the council, but also the health service, the police, the fire and rescue people, and anybody else that can come along, and business community, for instance, schools, and religious communities.
Okay, so what about your portfolio? What committees do you sit on? I understand you're chairing one of the big planning committees.
No, I don't actually chair. I sit on a planning
committee. You're sitting on it, okay.
Which is DC North, Development Control North. I also sit on Sustainable Development and Transport, the Audit Committee, and I'm chair of Public Rights of Way and Legal and Local Greens.
Okay, so with the planning one particularly, what kind of things have you been looking at? I know you can't go into any detail, but what sort of applications have you been looking at?
Well, we've looked at some quite tough stuff out at Avonmouth. There's been some very contentious. There was the WB4 palm oil plant that we rejected. They've gone to a review of that. And also the Viridor incinerator, we turned that down as well. So they're quite high-profile things that may well go to appeal.
Can you give us an idea of the sort of pressure on you to maybe not necessarily to vote with your conscience on these committees, but to be told, well, actually, you're going to have to vote this way because the council, otherwise the council will just simply have to spend loads of money fighting an appeal?
Well, yes, it's a difficult path to tread, but what we try and do is to look for a legal reason for refusing the application. In the case of Viridor, we refused it on the fact that it was going to be too much capacity in Avonmouth for the handling of waste, because we already had the New Earth plant there, and there's another one just up the road in South Gloucestershire and so on. And we turned the Viridor one down on the fact it was unneeded capacity. The WB4 plant was much more difficult to do because of, obviously, the source of the material we were told, in other words, palm oil, was not something we could take into consideration. But we decided that that was up to interpretation of the planning guidelines and chose to interpret them in one way and not the way that perhaps the officers would have wished we had done so.
Now, if you could just do one thing to sort of tweak the planning system, because we get lots of people on here over the months sort of saying, well, it's actually unfair. What would you do if you had the chance to?
Well, I think what I would do is to make it more holistic, because we have to work under strict guidelines that we can't consider knock-on effects. We can't consider, for instance, the big things at Avonmouth, as you know, is riddled with railways from the days of the smelter and other things there. And every major planning application that comes up, I sit there and say, are we going to feed this through the rail network? And they say, well, that's not actually a material consideration. And I just think we should take a much bigger and broader view of these large-scale developments that obviously create more traffic on the roads, produce pollution and things like that. We should take a bigger view.
Well, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers has managed to get through the traffic this evening and is joining us too. Martin, we just heard on the news there about MI5, that we have to be prepared possibly for an attack from the real IRA. And also, when we heard about a week or so ago, that the real IRA are threatening to attack the bankers. What are your thoughts on this, the announcement today?
Well, I mean, I think there is palpably a threat. I mean, as the person was saying from the other side of the Irish Sea, there have been 40 attacks so far this year in Northern Ireland. And I think the only hope for the dissident Republicans is to carry out attacks, because their political support is very minimal. That's not to say that they don't have some political support. They do. But I think many people on the Republican side who are disillusioned with the peace process still don't necessarily support attacks. But, of course, you don't need large numbers of people to be a very big nuisance.
Well, why are they disillusioned with the peace process? Because we've just seen some of these former terrorists now actually participating in government. Surely that's what they wanted all along.
Well, I think sensible Republicans and the mainstream of the Republican movement know very well that the peace process has, in fact, been quite a big success from their point of view. And that it's foolishness to imagine otherwise. But you can understand one of the things the real IRA was saying in the interview they gave to The Guardian the other week was that they are expecting a large underclass to develop as a result of the economic problems that Ireland and Britain are suffering, and they're thinking of younger people who've got no job prospects, and they're kind of almost rubbing their hands with glee at the idea that they'll be able to recruit these youngsters and, you know, point them in the direction that they want to point them in. I think there is a great deal of disillusion both sides of the Irish border with the way in which things have been managed. But I think the vast majority of people on both sides of the divide in Northern Ireland support the peace process. And as you know, we did a big special on it a few weeks ago, and we covered all of this.
What about the idea, though, of attacking bankers? That sounds a bit nuts to me. IRA, before they finished their bombing campaign, they were actually going for physical banks, weren't they? They had a big bomb at the Baltic Wharf.
The military operation from the mainstream provisional IRA point of view was the bombing of the Baltic Exchange, which then led to the British government opening negotiations with them because of the physical damage that they did. I think that the real IRA are trying to make hay out of the current difficulties, economic and social, on both sides of the Irish border. And in a sense, the answer to that is to solve those problems, and therefore they wouldn't have a cause to ride, would they?
And we heard on this programme last week about MI5 warning about possible attacks from the Somalis. I mean, it seems to be somebody different every week. I mean, should we really be taking this seriously?
Well, there is a big question about whether MI5 are genuinely independent in their analysis. Don't forget, they're a government agency. They want more funds. They need a threat, otherwise they're out of a job. And in the past, they have, you know, what the peace process in Northern Ireland should lead to is police primacy. That is to say, the Police Service of Northern Ireland, PSNI, to be in charge of security, and for MI5 and other agencies basically to take a step back. And, you know, the real IRA's threats, of course, are not making that any easier.
Trevor, can I just bring you in on this one? Because I wonder if Martin's exaggerating there. Do you think it's possible that the security services come up with these things at this time? For example, at the moment, there's big decisions being made about where the cuts are going to be.
Well, I don't think that they're wrong to bring it up, because they're damned if they don't and damned if they do, in a way. I wonder that we seem to be in a constant state of expecting some atrocity. I worked in London during the final days of the IRA campaign up there, Baltic Wolf and so on, and people just got on their lives as if nothing was going on. We were inconvenienced considerably by alleged bomb hoaxes or bomb hoaxes at tube stations, so you ended up walking all the way across London to get to Paddington. I don't know. I think it's wrong to blame particular groups of people as openly as they have done, because it just means that everybody goes around and looks more closely at the Somali community, for instance. I'm quite sure that disaffected youth, wherever it is going to find some sort of radical thing attractive, because they probably don't have a job and don't have anything else to occupy themselves. So I think we should take it a bit of a sort of pinch of salt and not go around with body armour on all the time.
Okay. So let's start this week by having a look at Tesco's, because this week there was a big protest, wasn't there, outside Bristol City Council House on College Green, about this the proposed new Tesco on Stokes Croft. This is a small Tesco Express shop you would think would just pop up and appear without anyone hardly noticing, but it seems that there are plenty of people in that area that are against it. What are your thoughts on that little? Whatever you know about that, Trevor?
Well, the little I do know about it, from a development control committee perspective, is that probably there were no good material reasons to turn it down. If they had have turned it down, then the legal and financial might of Tesco's would have ripped it apart in an appeal. I know there were some considerations over various aspects of the soundproofing of the plant room and so on, which have got to come back to committee. I do feel that we do seem to have more than a happy number of Tesco's in Bristol, although, on the other hand, a great number of our residents do rely upon them for their cheap food, or cheaper food, perhaps we should say, than other supermarkets. So it's clear that, looking at the correspondence in the Evening Post, there were just as many people who actually want it down there as those that don't. But all these things do have an effect upon the other shops in the community, which I always think is a terrible shame.
Well, our reporter Richard Cowley was down there on Tuesday outside the council house, and he brings us this report.
Elizabeth Winkler. I'm a food writer. I'm a local person. I live very near Stokes Croft, in Ashley, up the hill, Ashley Down. And I shop in Stokes Croft, and I've lived in Bristol for over 20 years, and I've seen Stokes Croft regenerate in a very culturally distinct way. It's a very unique place with original art and lots of exciting things happening, and yet it's coming up from the streets, and there's been a lot of difficulty, but the local people have pulled together to make Stokes Croft what it is. I think that all supermarkets have a terrifically unfair advantage. We only have to look at the Monopoly Commission to hear exactly how unfair it is. But just as an example, Tesco sources as cheaply as possible, but does it really all around the globe? And it goes to places where animal welfare rules are practically non-existent, goes to places where there's practically slave labour, and that's the way it manages to get its profits. It markets itself as very, very cheap, but our research shows actually that the local shops are cheaper. All supermarkets to some lesser or greater degree, but I would say that Tesco is definitely one of the worst. They're building an empire, a multinational empire, and the only thing they care about is profit. You only have to look at their profits for this year in April, nearly $3.5 billion profits. That is going to the shareholders. That is not being passed on to local people. I was at the Soil Association, but I write a food blog. My concern is health. My concern is that people, the way to eat well on a budget, you have to learn to cook. If you go to Tesco and buy ready meals, that is not the way forward, but that's what Tesco is promoting. I would prefer to be shopping an independent shop which is sourcing its organic food from a local organic farm.
You need an example of that?
Yeah, Radford Mill Farm on Picton Street, just behind Tesco's Better Food supermarket, which is about a 20-minute walk from the proposed Tesco.
Okay.
There are 38 Tesco's in Bristol. Just look at Tesco's own website. 38 in Bristol, we don't need any more.
Okay, thank you very much.
And thank you very much to Richard Cowley for that report. Can we start with you then, Martin? Is there really any problem with having as many stores as Tesco want in the city?
Well, I think it comes back to what Trevor was saying earlier about the planning law not taking into account holistic arguments. And also, of course, the unfairness whereby developers can appeal against a decision, but local communities and councils can't appeal against decisions which go against them. Planning law, as we've said on this programme, or I've said on this programme several times, is very much geared in favour of the developer. As Trevor was saying with the Avon Mouth incinerator and the palm oil, the issue of the palm oil couldn't even be brought forward because it's not a planning issue. It's a wider issue.
Yeah, but in this case, it's just an open and shut case. You know, Tesco have brought a couple of shops and they just want to turn it into a shop. Why shouldn't they be able to?
Well, I think the planning law is far too much in favour of the developer. It needs to, you know, the playing field needs to be levelled. There may be a case for having a Tesco some places, but you can see there's obviously some objections there. A lot of people feel disempowered if the planning law just seems to ride roughshod over their concerns. And the planning law has always historically been on the side of the developer.
I do actually wonder how long this shop's going to last there. If the People's Republic of Stokes Crofton, the local people really don't want it, I mean, surely, you know, it may have to close for whatever reason. I don't know if Tesco's going to manage to stay there.
I think it's very interesting that the local research shows that local existing shops are cheaper than Tesco's. And I think that's largely true, actually. I live on Stapleton Road, and many of those shops are cheaper than supermarkets, no doubt about it.
So, Trevor, are you happy to see Tesco's popping up everywhere, these little Tesco expresses?
No, for all the very good reasons that we've just talked about. I have no problem with any company making a good profit, because, after all, that's what they're there to do. The thing that worries me about Tesco's and the other supermarkets is the fact that they are destroying the farming community by constantly driving down the prices. It's, you know, to make a margin of that size on, one assumes it was 1 month, perhaps, or 3 months, is fantastic. Now, the farmers suffer at the one end and the local shops suffer at the other, but I agree, they seem to price their goods in Tesco's to reflect where they are, and some of the Tesco's are nowhere near as cheap as others. I think it's a big problem, and I wouldn't want to see any more. After all, we have one in Clifton, for instance, and we also have a co-op now, and the prices are very much the same, but I think the food is better in the co-op. The quality of the food is better in the co-op, but, you know...
But nothing can be really done, can it, from a democratic point of view? Because this is like Tesco's is like a bulldozer. They go wherever they want to go.
Well, yes, I mean, they have a huge land bank. So they buy up these places and they can develop them, and of course if the planning is already there for a one use, then it's a bit difficult to overturn it. I can only hope that, as we said, that the Republic of Stokes Croft will vote with their feet on this.
Okay, now it was a big week for speeches this week, and one of the speeches I particularly enjoyed was Vince Cable's speech on Wednesday to the Lib Dem conference. And as a Lib Dem councillor, I just wonder what you thought of these speeches. Nick Clegg's speech, I think it was Monday. His speech sort of was a little bit limp, and he was saying things like, "Oh, just stick with it," and there wasn't anything really exciting. Why is it, do you think, that Vince Cable is constantly upstaging Nick Clegg, who's supposed to be party leader?
Well, I don't think he upstages him. I think Clegg was right to say stick with it, because obviously there are a vast number of Liberal supporters out there.
It's not really an exciting rallying call, though, is it, for the party?
Well, we have to see how things develop. But Cable, I thought, was good, because I thought Cable had gone over to the dark side. And he came up with these ideas and so on that I think, you know, most people out there on the street would agree with.
Anyway, let's go back to spring of this year, just before the election, and have a listen to what Vince Cable had to say about the economy back then.
There will be spending cuts, but they must not be forced through too soon. because that will make the recession worse. And that's not just my view. Sir Alan Budd, the Conservatives' designated head of fiscal policy, thinks the same. The timing, the speed of cuts must reflect the state of the economy, not some political dogma. But cuts there will be, and we've spelt out some of them already. Serious public sector pay restraint for the next 2 years, no bonuses in the public sector. Nobody will get a pay rise over £8 a week, and absolutely no bonuses at all throughout the public sector.
Well, that's Vince Cable speaking back before the general election at the Lib Dems Spring Conference. Now, he's talking about public sector pay freeze. He's not talking about massive redundancies in the public sector. He's also saying we've got to make sure that the economy is picking up before we do these cuts. And actually, we're hearing this week again that there's less and less mortgages being given out every week and more problems for business. So it doesn't look like he's actually doing what he said he was going to do at all.
Well, I think the situation is very fragile at the moment. On the one hand, we have the public spending review, which is coming along second half of October, when the councils will know how their budgets are going to be fixed for the next 2 years, and also what infrastructure projects are going to be supported and those that aren't. I think most people are very concerned that trying to reduce the deficit within the lifetime of one parliament is a bit overdoing it, and it should be at least two. The trick, of course, is to make the cuts without stifling the improvements in the economy. And as an industrialist, I know that the best time to invest is in a recession, because everything is cheaper, machines are cheaper, and so on. And I'm concerned that we're cutting important things like the money going into research into green things like wave power and so on, and we're going to be cutting some infrastructure projects that could bring great benefits to the travelling community and also create jobs.
So are you convinced that message is getting through to your party leadership though?
Well, no, I'm not, I have to say, but as Clegg said, we have to suck it and see. And the proof of the pudding is going to be a couple of years down the track.
Well, I suppose Tony's calling me in here. I'm glad to hear the measured response from Trevor there, because I think what we really need in a situation like this is for there to be a very, very calm discussion about the choices that we face. I'm not convinced that we need to cut anything at all, and I know that this is not the position of the Labour leadership. I suspect that what may happen, and I did actually put this to Nick Clegg the other week when he was in Bristol, is that what may happen is that what's happened in Ireland is that attempts to cut public expenditure lead, in fact, to recession, which then increases your deficit. This is what happened in the 1980s. And then, of course, you lose. What's happened in Ireland is they then lost their credit rating. And we saw that the Irish economy is still going down in the last 3 months. It was on the news yesterday. Now, if the private sector is such a wonderful regenerative mechanism, as some people in the Conservative leadership seem to believe, then the cuts will simply lead to opening space for private sector investment and the economy will pick up. I think that is a fundamental misunderstanding of how the economy works. I think ultimately people will be ready for an expansion of public expenditure in order to reflate the economy, but they'll only be ready for that when they've put their hand in the fire and realise that it burns. Now, I may be wrong. It may be that the economy will pick up as a result of this careful management, which Trevor, I'm sure, would like to see. But I suspect not, because I think basically private capitalism run under the ideology of the last 30 years, the efficient market hypothesis and so on, basically that is over and it's not going to work. I mean, Vince Cable himself said there'll have to be a rebalancing of the economy in favour of the private sector. I don't think that's the way out of the crisis.
Okay, let's go back to Vince now. And he was calling the bankers spivs. I imagine you were wringing your hands, Martin. It's the sort of thing you've been talking about here over the last few weeks. But let's have a listen to what he had to say.
It's hardly rocket science, is it?
And among the obstacles is the threat to recovery from a credit squeeze by banks on our small businesses. And on banks, I make no apology for attacking the spivs and gamblers who did more harm to the British economy than Bob Crowe could achieve in all his wildest Trotskyite fantasies.
And they did it while paying themselves outrageous bonuses underwritten by the taxpayer. There's much public anger about the banks, and I have to say it's well deserved. But I'm not here seeking retribution. We have a pressing practical problem, which is the lack of capital for sound non-property business. And many firms say, they tell me, that they're already being crippled by banks' charges and restrictions. And the Chancellor and I have set out a range of sticks and carrots to get banks to support the real economy. And tough interventions will be needed if the capital which could be used to support business and business lending is frittered away in bonuses and dividends.
Well, tough talk from Vince Cable Wednesday this week at the Lib Dem conference. Trevor, you know, this is small businesses are being crippled by the banks. How come we're however many months it is, 4 months after the general election, and they're still being crippled?
Well, yes, this is a problem we have with the banks, is that one arm is the sort of bank down the road that you go and put your money in and you manage your affairs through, which probably doesn't make very much money at all. But other parts of the banking, the same banking empire, the hedge funds and all the other traders and so on, make colossal profits. Now, my view is that as a taxpayer, we bailed them out. They owe us that money, and that money should be repaid before they start paying themselves huge bonuses.
Well, don't you think Vince should be twisting David Cameron's arm and actually getting some action on the banks?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the counterpoint, of course, is that people say, well, if you stop paying all these big bonuses, these people will disappear to another country. But other countries are going almost down the same path as ours. And it was a bit like in my industry that printers used to move around to get the highest wages. And eventually, at the end of the day, some of those companies paying the highest wages had gone, you know, and market reality came back. And I have a problem with the banks operating the way they are. I know they have to rebuild their balance sheets, which means that they have more money inside them. But when the bank rate is 0.5% and they're lending it at something 5 or 6%, and they're paying themselves huge bonuses before they pay the taxpayer back, that's got to be changed.
Of course, the big criticism of Gordon Brown was that he wasn't tough enough with the banks, and it just seems that whole thing has carried on, you know. Well, nothing's changed.
Oh no, it would appear that to be so. We can just but hope that going forward things were going to be better.
Martin?
I think we'd have had a similar problem if the Labour Party had won the election, because the banks and the private banking system has been mismanaged for a generation. We really need to accept. I mean, I welcome many of the things Vince Cable was saying there, but I expect a Labour Chancellor would have said the same things, and he wouldn't necessarily have had the power to do anything about it any more than Vince Cable has. What we've done is we've allowed a kind of Frankenstein's monster to develop. I mean, the whole of allowing investment banking and retail banking to be done by the same organisations, that was forbidden in the 1930s and stayed forbidden until the 1990s, when the whole thing was deregulated as a result of pressure from the City of London and Wall Street.
Anyway, the final quote we're going to have from Vince Cable's speech, because as you can tell, I quite liked it, so I took quite a lot out of it, is this one about the cosy magic circle of auditors, lawyers and investment bankers.
Of course, we need successful business. But let me make it quite clear. The government's agenda is not one of laissez-faire. Markets are often irrational or rigged. So I'm shining a harsh light onto the murky world of corporate behaviour. Why should good companies be destroyed by short-term investors looking for a speculative killer, while their accomplices in the city make fat fees? Why? Why do directors sometimes forget about their wider duties when a cheque's waved in their face? Capitalism takes no prisoners, and it kills competition when it can, as Adam Smith explained over 200 years ago. So I want to protect consumers, and I want to keep prices down, and I want to provide a level playing field for small business. So we must be vigilant right across the economy, whether it's in the old industries of economics textbooks, or the newer privatised utilities, or the cosy magic circles in audit and law and investment banking. Competition is central to my pro-market, pro-business agenda.
Well, you've got a big round of applause for that. Martin, can you just have your comments on that one?
Well, I think I agree with virtually all of it, apart from the last bit about competition. The idea that competition is the answer to all of your problems is simply not the case.
Capitalism kills competition, isn't
it? Yes, capitalism kills competition, therefore capitalism has to be regulated to preserve competition. Now, that's quite an insight, but I'm a socialist, and actually I don't always believe in competition. I think certain things are better managed on a big scale, but that can't be a competitive... that can't be done in a competitive way. I mean, I think in the end we're going to have probably a publicly owned banking system, which will actually have a different set of criteria on which it lends funds to those who are trying to borrow. But nobody is prepared to think like that yet. We are still trying to resurrect the private banks. Eventually we will realise that what we've got to do is kill them off and create something else completely. But it will take a while.
Now, Trevor, Lib Dem councillor for Clifton, do you think Vince is angling for the leadership of the Liberal Democrat Party here with this kind of talk?
No, he's not. No, he doesn't want to be leader.
So what's he up to?
Well, I think he's putting a very big mark in the sand, saying this is where the Liberal Party are coming from, and this is what we expect the coalition to deliver.
But if you imagine your little magic circle of these auditors, lawyers, investment bankers all sort of together, how on earth is the condemned government and the coalition going to break that magic circle?
That is a very good question. I don't think there's too many of us around this table who've got the answer to that. But it does need breaking. For a short time, I was involved in the production of printed matter for the demutualisation of the building societies and then the conversion of those to banks. And we made quite a lot of money out of that, I'm pleased to say. But the lawyers and the merchant banks that came into Advisor made stonkingly huge sums. Really, you know, three merchant banks advising the Halifax or whatever it was. And I always said that once you demutualize something, you're bringing in you don't just have the lenders and the borrowers, you've now got the shareholders. And that isn't going to work because now you've got to make a profit that's going to go to someone else. And
yeah, but Vince is doing exactly the same, isn't he, with Royal Mail. He's obviously it's not a bank, but what he's doing is he's bringing in a whole bunch of shareholders that are going to be wanting to take profits from the Royal Mail, which weren't there beforehand.
Well, I think it's much deeper than that with the Royal Mail, as little as I know, that we need to see a lot of restructuring there and making a more efficient business grow. I think that it's difficult to think of who's going to invest it, who's going to buy it when it's got a £5 billion hole in its pension fund, which somebody's got to do something about, and only makes a small profit. So I think there's a lot more to go before we see the end of that one.
So can I get you on this one, Martin? How do we break this magic circle, the auditors, the lawyers and the investment bankers?
In a previous generation, in the 1950s, we had conservative governments under people like Harold Macmillan and even Edward Heath in the 70s. And the Conservative Party in those days did not believe in laissez-faire capitalism. They believed in a managed capitalism, and I would hope that the kind of things we're talking about would not necessarily be rejected by thinking conservatives. What I want to see is the right policies pursued, whoever is in the government. But I think we've got to recognise that basically the Thatcherite experiment, which started in 1979, has been a disaster for Britain and a disaster for the world. And if conservatives in particular can bring themselves to recognise that all of the deregulation of the city in the 80s and all the rest of it was wrong, then there is some hope that we might get to a sensible discussion about what needs to be done now. But people are still basically living in a dream world where all of that was right but just went wrong a little bit. It wasn't right in the first place and it's gone wrong catastrophically. And we need, for the country's sake, a Conservative leadership that understood that would be more use. People like us trying to force through the necessary measures will face resistance. If the Conservative government was to take those necessary measures, I, for one, would support them. But I can't see them doing it at this stage of the game.
Well, it's 20 to 6 now, and time to take a break from our news review to hear our guest Trevor Blythe's choice of music. Now, Trevor, what's the song and why did you choose it?
Well, it's not actually a song. This is very difficult because I like all sorts of music, but I brought along a track from Miles Davis's album A Kind of Blue, arguably by some the finest album ever made. It was more, there's four tracks on this. This is the second track. And it was recorded in one take, believe it or not, in 1959, and it sounds as fresh now as it did then.
Listening to BCFM's Friday Drive Time with me, Tony Gosling. Now, that was Freddie Freeloader, and still is Freddie Freeloader, by Miles Davis from the album A Kind of Blue, chosen by today's guest, Trevor Blythe, Lib Dem councillor for Clifton. Now, before we return to our review of the news this week, a reminder of the Friday Drive Time website, where you can see and even hear all previous shows back to Easter 2009. Listen again if you want, that is, at www.thisweek.org.uk. Now, back to the news review, and Martin, I wonder if you can start with this one. President Ahmadinejad last night told the UN most blamed the United States government for 9/11. Thursday, that is, most people apparently believe that the US government was behind the attacks of the September 11th, 2001. And this prompted the US and European delegations at the United Nations to leave the hall in protest. Addressing the General Assembly, Ahmadinejad said it was mostly US government officials and statesmen who believed Al-Qaeda Islamist militants carried out the suicide hijackings that brought down the New York's World Trade Center. Another theory, he said, was that some segments within the US government orchestrated the attack to reverse the declining American economy.
Well, I mean, Ahmadinejad saying these things is nothing new. He's said them before. And he's quite right to say that around the world, many people suspect the hand of the US or other Western security forces in these attacks. One other person who also thinks as he does is General Ivashov, who was the commander-in-chief of the Russian armed forces on September the 11th.
Well, that's hardly surprising, because the Russians and the Iranians have had a long-term alliance for decades.
Well, no, the Russians and the Iranians have an off-on-off relationship, but the point is that the Russians have no particular axe to grind here. They're just pointing out what they think they know. I went on a trade union delegation to Colombia in 2004, and many of the activists we spoke to there, who were under constant threat of assassination and torture from the US-backed government there, they didn't have much difficulty understanding the idea that the US security forces might have been involved in the attacks. And if you think back to the 1980s, when Colonel Oliver North was running around importing millions of dollars of cocaine to the United States in order to pay for weapons which were then used in terrorist actions inside Nicaragua, nobody was punished, nothing ever happened. If you know the history of the US security forces, the idea that they might have been involved in these attacks is not at all foolishness. The question of whether they were is a different matter. But Ahmadinejad, as a head of state, will be working on the basis of his own intelligence services briefings, as will General Ivashov, who is the head of the Russian armed forces. Now, I think that the Western powers have just got to accept that their credibility about this is, when they say, oh, it's nothing to do with us and we're going to walk out, they can walk out if they like, but many of the other delegations in there will not be impressed by that.
Trevor, what's happened here is the president of Iran is claiming that the 9/11 attacks were aimed at reversing the declining American economy and its scripts on the Middle East in order to save the Zionist regime. At that point, delegates rose in a pre-arranged way, apparently, and exited the hall. That is, the US, the United Kingdom, Sweden, Australia, Belgium, Uruguay and Spain walked out. Now, no matter what you think about Ahmadinejad's statement, do you think that the walkout is a good thing, or do you think they're right to do that, our representatives at the UN?
The problem with this guy is that somehow we've got to engage him in a meaningful discussion about life, the universe and all that.
But you can't do that if you walk out, can you?
Well, precisely, but then it must be very difficult. I mean, he goes on here to talk about the fact that the Holocaust never happened and all this sort of stuff. I don't know. I think, like with most of these things, we were talking about the peace agreement in Northern Ireland a little while ago, somewhere, someone is talking to the people behind the scenes.
Can I just correct you there? Because apparently Ahmadinejad suggested that the Holocaust had been exaggerated as a pretext for war.
Right, okay.
During a New York meeting with US media owners and editors. That's what it says in the actual the report in The News, which is a Pakistani paper of that UN speech.
Yes, okay, thank you. But I mean, he can posture like this in public, but I'm just hoping that somewhere behind the scenes he's actually talking to some of the more meaningful people in his government about the issues that confront us with their regime.
Well, the big issue, of course, is the nuclear one, and we have our nuclear weapons, so why shouldn't he?
Well, I'm hoping sooner or later we won't have any here, that we scrap Trident and so on. But
well, of course, we have our nuclear power as well, so why shouldn't we? I mean, it's the nuclear power.
There's no reason why he shouldn't have nuclear power. But I feel that he has to be open to inspection.
What do you think about this whole business, though? Because the civil nuclear power is actually quite linked to the military, isn't it? I mean, in order to actually make nuclear weapons, you've got to have nuclear power stations.
Well, yes, you have to refine the plutonium that's produced from the nuclear power station, which is another whole process of great sophistication. But also, I'd imagine that somewhere or the other, you could probably buy it on the open market, or will be able to, with the number of people that have nuclear power stations around the world.
Martin, do you want to have a final word on this one?
I think that the West has got to understand, Ahmadinejad obviously is a rather unattractive character to many people in the West, but when he says about the 9/11 attacks, for example, that we suspect there's something more to this than is going on, the commission that investigated the attacks have actually said themselves, the people who sat on the commission, that the government lied to them and that they want a further investigation. And I think, sadly, as with the corruption inside the banks, the corruption inside the military-industrial complex in the West is pretty bad, pretty bad. And I think that there's got to be honesty and transparency if you're going to deal with these things. And that means, as we saw in Northern Ireland, that police primacy, not the security services making things up, but the police should investigate properly every kind of allegation of this kind.
I don't agree with that on the fact that in some way the US were involved in the destruction of the towers. I've just finished a book called The Looming Towers, and it's quite clear in that that the main problem, that the reason it happened, was the fact that the CIA and the feds had some sort of security wall between them, and each side had half the answers, as it were, half the information. And if they'd put that together, then it could have been prevented.
I think there is an issue of what they call let it happen on purpose, or mistakes. Like, for example, the fact that the Air Force were unable to intercept any of the four planes in 1.5 hours. But of course, if it was just incompetence, you'd expect some heads to roll. No heads have rolled. And as long as this question still remains, that the incompetence hasn't been properly dealt with and all the rest of it, then people out there in the wider world just don't take the Western powers' assertions that they had nothing to do with it at face value. They simply won't.
Well, you could say exactly the same about MI5, our internal security service, and the London 7/7 bombings, but let's not go there right now. Yes. Let's go on to a local story. Bristol Mobile Warden Service for the Elderly is poorer. This is by Matthew Hill at the BBC here in Bristol. The scrapping of residential wardens for older people in Bristol has led to a poorer service, the survey says. Bristol Older People's Forum sent questionnaires to people living in council housing right across the city. The forum found the new mobile wardens have left fragile residents feeling isolated and scared. 4 out of 5 people in sheltered accommodation said the service had worsened since the city council got rid of residential wardens 2 years ago. Now, I'm afraid the Lib Dems can't blame Labour for this one, Trevor. Lib Dems changed the policy in 2008.
Well, yes, we were faced with cuts, of course. And the other problem we had was a huge overspend coming through to support elderly people that the NHS were actually releasing from hospital rather sooner than they might have done in the past.
Well, these are some of the most vulnerable people in the city, and they're now feeling isolated and scared. So it sounds like a bit of a disaster to me.
Well, it's a problem that the private sector's had to face as well. My mother-in-law was in sheltered accommodation in North Somerset, and they had their warden removed, and they had a mobile warden. And the problem with that is, of course, that the elderly people want continuity of a face. They want to see the same face, and obviously they feel more secure if there's someone there.
Well, it's a matter of trust, isn't
it? It's a matter of trust, and they don't have this strange face appearing at the door every other day, because they're never quite sure who it is. So I can understand the point of view of the well-being feeling. But as far as I'm aware, I understand that actually the service is as good as it was.
Well, it says here, I mean, in the BBC report, the number of wardens has halved over the past 4 years. So how can there be the same level of service?
Well, that's because they're no longer resident within the residential home.
Martin?
I think at local level, when you've got constraints which you can't do anything about, it's always, obviously, one would like to have a better quality service, but it's felt that a better quality service can't be afforded. And at local level, there are always going to be difficult choices about things like this, because the actual budgets, if you like, are set elsewhere. The decisions to actually cut are taken elsewhere. But I think we have to ask ourselves a question as a society. Are we going to be prepared to sacrifice the well-being of our elderly people to bail out private bankers? And this is the question we were talking about in the first part of the programme. And I think the answer to that, when people actually look into their hearts, the answer to that is no. And what we really want is to improve our public services, cost what that is going to be, accept that there will be some deficit, and raise taxes. taxes on wealthy people. Because in the 1950s, the top rate of tax in Britain under a Conservative government was 96%. But the sky didn't fall, the money was paid up, and we had a different kind of attitude towards public spending than we've got now.
Well, the attitude of the wealthy is, of course, that they're just going to go skip over to the Channel Islands.
Well, they did it in the 1950s, but they didn't do it enough to cut the government's take of money. I mean, there is possibility to squeeze money out there if people were prepared to think about ways of doing it.
I mean, how do we deal with that attitude, Trevor? The people who Martin's saying that the really wealthy who should be paying tax and helping us now in our time of need, if you want, as a society, just skip off abroad.
We need to see how big the problem is, how many people have actually gone abroad, how much difference has that made to the income, the taxing income of the country and so on. I think it's quite right and proper that people shouldn't be non-doms for tax exile reasons. If they want to go and live in a foreign country to avoid paying tax, and then they stay there, basically.
Yeah, that's got to be the way. They're either on Team Britain or they're not.
Exactly.
Right, next story. A huge rise is on the cards if you want to park in Bristol city centre. This is from the Evening Post. City centre parking charges are set to go up by as much as 66%. Now, I think that's a bit more than inflation, isn't it? If hikes are approved by Bristol City Council, pay and display and short and long stay car parking charges all set to go up in a bid to raise an extra, well, £500,000 a year for the council's coffers. Sunday and bank holiday charges will also rise dramatically under the proposals to bring them in line with the cost of parking in the street on a Saturday. Trevor, what's going on? 66% price hike just at the time of a recession. What's going on here?
Well, it's a tough one. A lot of people would say city centre parking is too cheap anyway, compared with bus fares, for instance. There's this sort of dreadful imbalance that it's much cheaper to drive in and park there than it is to get on a bus. That's the first problem we've got. Certainly the shopping patterns, of course, have changed over the years, and there's many people trying to park in the centre now on a Sunday to go shopping as they are in the other day of the
week.
But
aren't people just going to skip off up to Cribbs Causeway where parking's free?
Well, I think yes. I mean, that's the argument people make. And I think that the success of Cabot Circus has shown that that's not really the case. People still like to sort of, I mean, the range of shops is slightly different anyway, and the, you know, the feeling of the place is different and so on. But, you know, what we're hoping is that people will use the bus service, and the more people use the bus service, the cheaper the prices on the buses will be. So,
Do you think we've managed to get to grips with parking in the city? Because I know there's still all sorts of stuff up in the air about residence parking, particularly up in Clifton, which is your ward.
Yes, I mean, my view on residence parking is that it's difficult to do it in small areas such as Clifton Wood and in Kingsdown and so on. It's much better to think bigger and say, right, you know, we're going to have a donut around the city centre of residence parking. So that it's like a stone in a pond, isn't it? The whole thing ripples out. And I live in Clifton, and a lot of people drive into my street and park there, and I see them walk down to wherever their offices are, and I see them come back and drive off at going home time. It is very difficult for the residents, without a doubt, to try and park anywhere near their homes. Also, at night time, where you have centres of pubs and restaurants and so on, people come and park there. So in my particular street, it's hard to park there any time, except possibly on a Sunday afternoon. But, I'd like to see, you know, a much bigger approach taken by the council in trying to solve these problems, as they've done in other cities.
Martin, do you think it's fine just hiking up the prices for people parking in the city centre? Is that the sort of thing you want to see?
Well, I mean, you might want to increase parking prices in the city centre because you want to discourage people from using cars. But if you're going to do, I mean, you know, not just because you're trying to save money, but if you're going to do things like that, you've actually got to have a transport strategy for the city which involves doing something about the buses. But of course... As we know, in the 1980s and 1990s, we went down the road of deregulating the bus industry, and it's now run for the benefit of shareholders. And in fact, they're not really that bothered about the number of people they carry. That's not their target. The profit margin is the target. And of course, as we know, in the 50s, I think we talked about the 50s earlier, there used to be a Bristol bus company run by the council, which was, you know, part of, you know, there were more levers for the council to pull to solve transport problems than there are now. And it's another one of the legacies of this free market fetish that people got into. I mean, London Transport is still run by Transport for London, not by a lot of private sector competition. And I think that, you know, when it ain't broke, don't fix it. Lots of things in the past were actually done rather well. Perhaps we should go back and have another look.
10 seconds, Trevor. What are the Lib Dems going to do to sort out transport in the city generally?
We are encouraging other bus companies to come into Bristol to compete for the council-supported routes, and we're hoping that may introduce more competition.
OK, thanks very much, Trevor. We're coming up now to the Sky News at 6. That was Trevor Blythe, Liberal Democrat councillor for Clifton. After the news, we have more. So join us in 3 or 4 minutes' time. Thanks.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody...